I'd like to begin today's shiur with addressing a question which is very frequently asked nowadays. May or may not be aware of it, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it is important to be able to respond at the very least on the level of Dhamma Lahashiv. And that is the contemporary attacks on free will. We mentioned earlier in the shiurim that throughout our history there have been many who have denied free will for all sorts of reasons. Some based off of the idea that there's divine foreknowledge, others based off of fate, and in modern times there's a different attack, one which is supposedly rooted in neuroscience and one in psychology. And we'll consider both of these briefly. So before beginning, we have to define some terms. And the first term is determinism. What does determinism mean? So I think the most straightforward definition of determinism was offered by a philosopher named Peter van Inwagen. And he said that determinism is true if the world is such that its current state is completely determined, A, by the laws of physics, and B, by past states of the world. Meaning to say, given everything that exists now, or everything that's happened until this point, plus the laws of physics, so then everything going forward is already determined. If I know the laws of physics perfectly and I know everything that's going on in the universe, then according to this theory of determinism, I'll be able to predict everything, at least theoretically. Practically, obviously, nobody could do this. But theoretically, one could know everything that would go forward. So essentially, according to this perspective, everything is already decided. And that, if that's the case, then there's no room for free will, right? If yesterday I was trying to decide whether I was going to have pea soup for lunch or onion soup, so I might have felt free. I saw these two options. I was thinking, which one should I have? But based off of the laws of physics, my decision was already made. Now, we already saw that there might be some Jewish thinkers who believe in something along these lines, Rabbeinu Kreskes, for example, but as we also saw, this isn't the mainstream view, and this is a view which is in fact very commonly accepted among contemporary philosophers, and the question is, what do we have to say about it? So, does determinism imply that we don't have free will? So the truth is that the dominant view among philosophers and legal theorists is something known as compatibilism, which means that free will is in fact compatible with determinism. Somehow, and this is a difficult word, somehow, but somehow or another, we're able to make free choices, even though those choices were determined by previous events and influences. And some of the theories of compatibilism are actually similar to some of the theories that we saw before taken by the Rishonim with respect to reconciling divine foreknowledge and free will. And it's also probably true that for the most part, I think these answers are somewhat counterintuitive. But if you take a compatibilistic approach, then there's no problem assuming determinism and also assuming that there's free will. And this is, in fact, a very promising approach. But for the sake of argument today, we're going to presume incompatibility, that if it is the case that the universe, that all the future events are determined by the laws of physics and the past states of the universe, so then there would be no room for free will. So are there any other resolutions? So we'll consider two. The first is that perhaps contemporary physics does not support determinism. Maybe the world is not deterministic. In fact, modern physics, for the most part, is predicated upon quantum physics, which assumes that the universe is indeterministic. Now, first of all, before going forward, I should say that I'm not expert in any of this stuff, by any means. Again, I'm simply present what I've seen or what appears lenius daiti. So if we that's one answer. Answer is that, yes, determinism and free will are incompatible, but the world or the universe is indeterministic, as can be seen by quantum mechanics. Now, others object, and they say no, that the type of indeterminism implied by quantum mechanics is not sufficient to justify free will. So while it might be the case that a given electron may be inherently unpredictable, there's no way to predict its course, but with respect to larger phenomenon, the universe is in fact highly predictable. That being the case, is it really possible that the indeterminacy within on the quantum level is sufficient to justify our free will? Maybe. Maybe the fact that the universe is inherently unpredictable, it is inherently indeterministic, the fact that it happens to be predictable still leaves room for free will. But again, for now we'll assume that too is incorrect, that quantum physics is insufficient to justify the type of indeterminacy that would be necessary to allow for free will, and we'll consider a third approach. And this approach, I think, is very basic in that it really relates to recognizing who we truly are. You see, if there's more to us than our physical bodies, if there's more to consciousness than simply the neurons that exist within our brains, so then the notion of free will is no longer objectionable. Or to put it a little differently, the root of the scientific objection to free will lies in the assumption that our physical bodies, especially our brain, is the source for all human decision-making, and therefore it's subject to the deterministic laws of physics. Or to put it a little differently, scientists and philosophers would agree that if somewhere deep within the recesses of the brain there was something else that operated independently of the normal laws of physics, that was somehow tied to the free will or decision-making of the brain's owner, then there would be no longer any objection to free will. So why then are there many scientists that deny this possibility? Because they'll tell you that there's no scientific evidence for the existence of such a substance within the brain. They've performed many brain scans and CAT scans, and nobody's ever seen this mysterious substance in the brain that might be responsible for these free decisions. However, we would respond that that's not a very good test. Meaning to say, going back to the very beginning of the sugya, we noted that man's free will is not just a result of his higher intellect. Malachim, for example, have a very high intellect, maybe higher than ours, but the pashup shot is they have no free will. Rather, the free will comes from our neshama, our tzelem Elokim. We believe that there's more to us than simply our brains and our blood and our bones. We are not simply just physical creatures. And in fact, that is the central lesson of the opening chapters of Bereishis, that we're comprised of body and soul. that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a neshama, and that's what makes us human. Man d'nafach medilei nafach. What makes us who we are is our neshama. We're not just a guf, but we're a composite of a guf and a neshama. And that's why when we die, we don't actually die. Death is the separation of the guf and a neshama, but we believe in a nitzchias neshama, and therefore we will continue to exist after we die, even as our body is buried and decomposes. We are a guf and a neshama, and it's the neshama that's the basis for our freedom. It's not the case that all of our decisions are simply a result of our guf. If we want to think about it a little differently, the objection to free will from a scientific perspective is rooted in a certain approach that scientists take for granted, which the Ramban, in actually Vayikra Perek Tezayin, argues is contrary to that of the Torah. Take a look at the page 34 in your packet. So the Ramban here writes as follows, the top of the page. Or, sorry, bottom of 33, I guess. Yeah. Where it says, Vayikra Tezayin Ches. Ki hayinu tzrichim lachsom pi hamischakmim b'teva hanimshachin acharei hayivani asher hikchish kol davar zulasi hamorgashlo. We have to close the mouth of those who make themselves wise in nature, who follow Aristotle, who denied whatever he could not comprehend with his senses. Vehegis daito lachshov hu v'talmido harishayim ki kol inyan shelo hisig elav hu b'svaraso einanu emes. The approach of Aristotle was that anything that I could perceive, anything that I could detect with my senses exists, and anything that I don't see doesn't exist. That approach was, context of the Ramban is somewhat different, take a look, but for our purposes, in a sense, that is really the approach that leads to this critique against free will, which is that anything that we can't see doesn't exist. We can't see the neshama, so there's no neshama. And if there's no neshama, and you assume a deterministic world universe, and moreover, you assume incompatibility, and moreover, so then you could say, well, what room is there for free will? And our response is that there's no reason to assume that you would be able to see the neshama in a brain scan, because the neshama is not a physical existent, and you're using the wrong tools to discover it. Try to find a neshama, it's like using your eyes to see something invisible. And therefore, even if we grant all of those assumptions, which, as I said before, are not necessarily true, but even if we do grant them, then there would be no expectation to see the neshama in a brain scan. And to put it a little differently, science has nothing to say about this question, because it's not fundamentally a scientific question. It has nothing to do with the physical universe. And just to take it one step further, the idea is really central to our entire religion. In other words, if the scientific objection is rooted in the worldview of materialism, that there's nothing besides the material, so if that's true, then chas v'shalom, there could be no God, because God isn't material. So even though we may not be able to scientifically be able to prove the existence of the soul. There's also nothing in science that is problematic or says that it doesn't exist. Happens to be that even from a scientific perspective, it's not so clear that materialism explains consciousness. We talked about at the beginning of the year the lack of basis for the evolution of consciousness. But again, we'll leave all that aside. Even if there was, that's not something that one would expect to be able to see. So that's the basic mahalach, I want to say, in terms of that question. Very briefly, what about psychology? So, another challenge, well, actually before that, another challenge that some raise based off of neuroscience is that it could be demonstrated that certain reactions take place without conscious thought. So, for example, experiments have shown that particular actions like pressing a button are initiated at first before they enter consciousness. So some say that if that's true, if we're making our decisions without conscious awareness, then how could we be responsible for those decisions? So again, I think if you think about it, this isn't a particularly troubling point. Those types of experiments don't contradict the type of free will that we have been advocating. The types of decisions that might take place before conscious awareness are amoral. They're nothing to do with the type of free will, which is nogea to us, which is moral decisions, the decision about doing right or doing wrong, helping a person, hurting a person. All of those take place consciously, and we're aware of that. And the fact that, might be true that, I press a button when I hear a ding before I feel the urge to press a button, doesn't really present too much of a problem. Okay, yeah.
I recall that, putting on my every decision is good.
I don't think these are decisions, if the experiment is right. But you can show me what you're referring to. But I don't think so.
In light of the Ravid, the Ravid and the Rambam, Ravid already limited Bechira to a very small percentage.
We'll get back to that point. Certainly, it's correct if you take that approach, but even if you don't, I don't think this is too much of a kasha. Within the realm of psychology, so there have been those who have argued that all of our decisions are simply a result of our nature and our nurture, and therefore, again, what room is there for free will? And here, too, I think that if we go back to many of the sources that we've seen, including the Rambam, and the Meiri, and the Tashbates, and the Ramchal, and Mariyavitz, and Rav Dessler, and the like, all of those sources don't deny the very potent effect that nature and nurture plays on the decisions a person makes. I don't think if your argument was that we're a tabula rasa and everything that we do is not affected by our upbringing or the like, so then, in fact, we would have what to respond to. But the truth is that, as we saw, many, many, perhaps most Jewish thinkers certainly agree that our unconscious minds are saturated with instincts and biases and habits and emotional responses that silently shape many, many of our decisions. But again, to take Rav Dessler's Mahalich, it's not those decisions that we're judged based off of. And everybody has an area in which they're free. And we all feel that area. And within that area, so that's where meaningful free will takes place. And if that's the case, then again, I don't really think one would be particularly troubled. That's point one that I wanted to talk about today. Point two is another objection raised against free will, and that is the problem of prophecy. So take a look. It's the Rambam in Perek Vav, Halacha Hey, page 42. 41, I guess. Bottom of 41. So if you recall, in the Perek Hey of the Rambam, we saw this a number of weeks ago, the Rambam dealt with the challenge of free will with respect to divine foreknowledge. Now in Perek Vav, he addresses a different question. V'alo kasav b'Torah v'avadum v'inu osam harei gazer al ha-mitzriyim lasos ra v'ksiv v'kam ha'am hazeh v'zanach harei Elohei nechar ha'aretz harei gazer al Yisrael lavod kochavim u'mazalos v'lama nifra mehem. The Torah predicts certain things, for example, the Shibud of Mitzrayim, and if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer that these things would happen, so then why were the Egyptians held accountable? Why did God punish the Egyptians with the 10 plagues? If after all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had been gozer that they enslaved the Jewish people? That's the Rambam's question. Now before we look at his answer, let's ask a different question, which is, didn't the Rambam already deal with this in Perek Hey? When he asked the question about free will and foreknowledge, and the Rambam answered that there's no contradiction between divine foreknowledge and free will, because if we understand the nature of divine knowledge, so then there'd be no contradiction. So then, doesn't that answer this as well? Again, Rambam said before that just because God knows the future, that doesn't mean that the Egyptians didn't have free will. So yes, God knew that the Egyptians would enslave the Jewish people, but still the Egyptians could have somehow had free will. There's compatibility between foreknowledge and free will, divine foreknowledge. And therefore, that would answer this question as well. And in fact, if you take a look at the Lecha Mishnah, he raises this question, and he simply answers, yeah, in Achanami, the question was answered based off of Perek Hey, and Rambam over here is giving a different answer. The Or Sameach, though, which is on the top of page 42, the Or Sameach has one line, Kol Hadibor Azetos, referring to the Lecha Mishnah, Shiyadiyas Hanavim Machreches. So what does he mean? There's a simple distinction. Remember, what was Rambam's resolution about the foreknowledge problem? That divine foreknowledge doesn't contradict free will. The way in which God knows things is compatible with free will. But that's the way in which God knows something. Once Hashem tells a Navi, so it's no longer divine foreknowledge, it's human foreknowledge, because a human knows it. When Hashem told Avraham Avinu at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, Ki ger yezar acha be'eretz lo lohem, v'avadum v'inu osam, so now it's human foreknowledge. Avraham Avinu knows what's going to happen in the future. If Avraham Avinu knows what's going to happen in the future, so then there is, at least according to Rambam, it would seem, a contradiction between human foreknowledge and free will. And therefore, the answer that he gave in Perek Hey is insufficient, and therefore the Rambam has to give a different answer. So what is the Rambam's answer? By the way, this distinction might be seen in other sources. In Rashi, for example, the Marshal points out, holds of this distinction. I guess we won't get to that now, but there's a number of places where, other places besides the Rambam, where this important distinction comes up. So what's the Rambam's answer? So go back again to the previous page. Lefisha lo gazar al ish ploni hayadua shiyehu hazone ella kol echad ve'echad me'osan hazonim lavod kochavim hazalos ilu lo ratza lavod lo haya oved v'lo hodio habore ella min hago shel olam halam hazedome le'omer ha'amazeh yeba en tzadikim v'rishayim lo mipnei zeh yomar harasha bar nigzar alav shiyeh rasha mipnei shehodia lemoshe shiyeh rishayim b'Yisrael k'inyan sh'nemar ki lo yechdal avyon mekarav haaretz v'chein ha-mitzriyim kol echad ve'echad me'osan ha-mitzriyim v'hamiriyim li'Yisrael ilu lo ratza lehara lohem harishas biyado shel gazar al shiyadua ela hodio shesof zar'o asid lehishtabed be'eretz lo lohem. Kfar Amarnu, Shein Koach Ba'adam Leida, He'ach Yeda HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Dvarim Asidim Lios. So the Rambam answers that a person might have knowledge, general knowledge, about what's going to happen in the future, but because that's just general knowledge, so there's still room for freedom. Hashem told Avram Avinu that the Jewish people would be persecuted in Eretz Lo Lahem, but which land, and even if it's going to be in Mitzrayim, which Mitzrayim we're going to persecute and which ones weren't, all that isn't determined, and therefore there's room for freedom. It's actually similar to the point we just made a couple minutes ago about high level of predictability in the larger scheme of things, even if things are totally predictable in a quantum level. Or to put it a little differently, you know, if you have a if you ask the people who cook in the caf for a dinner, so right, you have a choice of dark meat and white meat. You still have that choice? When I was there, that's what they would ask you. So a lot of people, you know, get chicken. So how do they know? Maybe, you know, everybody's going to pick white meat tonight. So the answer is that you could predict with quite a, if you're good, with a high level of reliability, even though each person, you know, could choose whether or not they want a white meat or dark meat. Certainly with respect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the fact that Hashem or told Nevi'im about certain broad things that are going to happen, like the nation will stray after Avodah Zarah, or the Jewish people will be persecuted, that doesn't take away for free will, because each and every individual actor still has their freedom. That's the Rambam's answer. The Ravid objects. Take a look at the Ravid below, page 42 again. Amar Avram, Elehim arichos dvarim she'enan mitubalim v'chai roshi kemat ani omer shem divrei nairas yomar abore lezonim lama zanisa v'ani lo hizkarticha b'shem kidei shetomar she'alecha gazarti yomru lo azonim v'al michal agzeirascha al osan shelo zanu hine lo nizkan agzeirascha. Agav, you see also that the Ravid doesn't give his answer from Parakeh as well. Just like we noted that the Rambam gives a different answer to Parakeh and Parak Vav because he understood it was a different question, so to the Ravid, who gave a different answer in Parakeh, gives a different answer to Parak Vav because, again, it's a different question. So what's the Ravid answering? So first of all, what does he object to the Rambam? Then we'll read what he answers. So he says that, so, Al Michalag Zeirascha, the Mitzri who beat the Jew, who threw the Jewish baby into the river. So, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu were to go to him and say, why did you do it? So he would say, because you said. And Hashem would say, but wait, you didn't have to do it. And he could say back, Al Michal Gzeirascha. And therefore, the Ravid does not like this answer. Now again, the Rambam might respond that events are predictable on a macro level, though individual actors remain free, and the like. But the Ravid nevertheless thinks that that level, it would seem, of unpredictability, since the gzera of avadu inu osam is so precise, is so certain, then that answer isn't correct. Okay, it's true. But it could happen that one day the cafeteria will run out of white meat, you know. So, before we get to the Ravid's answer, I'd like to make another distinction, note another distinction between Parakei and Parakvav. Again, the first distinction, the question of the Lecha Mishnah, why does the answer of Parakei does not help for Parakvav? So the Or Sameach answered, because this is no longer a matter of divine foreknowledge, it's human foreknowledge. There's another, perhaps even more basic, distinction between the question of Parakei and Parakvav. And that is that if you look at Parakei again, Parakei is an epistemological question. How is foreknowledge compatible with the indeterminism of free will? And to that he offers a philosophical answer, namely the distinction between divine foreknowledge and human knowledge. In Parakvav, his question is different. It's, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer, look at his question. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer, that a certain thing would happen, then how is it fair that a person be held accountable for that which was already nigzar? Right? In his question in Parakei, he didn't mention anything about a gzera. And that's his question. How is equity compatible with the gzera? HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes there that the Jewish people would be persecuted, Be'eretz Lo Lahem. And therefore, how can it be that the Egyptians were punished for carrying out the divine gzera? That's the Rambam's question. And he gives a different answer. What's his answer? His answer is that the gzera was not on any specific people, and therefore the gzera could have been carried out in multiple ways. And therefore, any particular person that chose to do evil was freely choosing to do evil. There was no gzera that particular person did do evil, and therefore he's held accountable for his free choice to do evil, because there's no gzera. If the gzera was absolute, it wasn't a gzera that va'avadum v'inu osam v'aretz lo lahem, but that ploni v'almoni ha-mitzri would be meshabed the Jewish people, so then in fact the Egyptians could not be punished because there was a gzera that they do what they did. But that isn't the case. There was a general gzera that could have been fulfilled in many different ways, and therefore no Egyptian can claim innocence based off of this. This is similar to what we saw a while back in Rav Sadia Gaon and the like, based off of that pasuk in Yechezkel.
What was the question in Parakei again?
Parakei was the epistemological question. How is free will compatible with the determinism that's implied by foreknowledge? Yes?
What's the social difference between the two questions?
Parakei has nothing to do with Xera. Parakei is not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes there and anybody to do anything. It's simply, if Hashem knows what I'm going to do, then at least the question assumes, how could I do otherwise? And if I could do otherwise, and it turns out I'm not free.
That only matters.
That's not Xera. It has nothing to do with Xera. The question of Perek Vav is, how could there be a divine plan and also there be freedom? And the answer is that the divine plan, at least that which is revealed to people, is very general in its scope. It's not specific in its scope. In other words, to put it a little differently, Hashem was gozer that the Jewish people would be enslaved. Fine. He wasn't gozer that any particular Egyptian was going to enslave them. He did know which Egyptian would enslave, because he had foreknowledge, right? So you see, both the question and the answer in Parakeh and Vav have nothing to do with each other. Yeah. So there aren't so specific. I mean, they're no Nevi'im, you know. The Nevuah that Shaul will become Melech is not really that. It's Hashem says to Shmuel, go appoint Shaul and be as the king. Or go appoint David to be the king. But even if it is the case that there are specific Nevuos, so and then if that's the case, then indeed with respect to those Xeros, then there might not be freedom, in which case a person wouldn't necessarily even be held accountable for those choices. But if they exist, they're few and far between, and they don't really relate to free will, and it wouldn't be much of a problem to say that with respect to those things there isn't free will, if in fact they're totally specific. But I don't think something like anoint Shaul as Melech, that was a tzivoy to Shmuel what to do. It wasn't something that in any way inhibited Shaul's freedom. Okay. Fine. So, what is the Ravid? Yeah.
Isn't Xera just a more concrete version of divine foreknowledge? I mean, I know they're not exactly the same.
No, I don't think so. I don't. A gzera is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's declaring that a certain thing will happen. It will absolutely happen. Foreknowledge is his knowledge of what's going to happen. Just to highlight the distinction, right? The answers, let's say, what we thought was the simplest answer of Sadia Gaon, the Rivash, and the like, that there's no logical contradiction between foreknowledge and free will, is only relevant for foreknowledge, not a gzera. A gzera means you will do X tomorrow, and I will make you do X. It's a gzera. It's going to happen.
I mean, God knows absolutely.
No. In other words, God knows what's going to happen, but it's, again, going back to, let's say, Rav Sadia Gaon's answer, he knows what we're going to freely choose. A gzera is he's going to cause us to do something. I could know what you're going to freely choose. And therefore we could say that my foreknowledge isn't the cause of your free choice. But if I say that this is going to happen tomorrow, not because I know it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's a gzera. Now, you could have taken a different approach, which is that these weren't gzeros. These were just Hashem's telling Avram Avinu what he knew was going to happen. And in fact, if you take the Or Sameach's approach, that's basically what he's answering, right? That this is just foreknowledge, right? The Or Sameach doesn't make this distinction. I think both of the distinctions, both chilukim we gave between Hay and Vav, are correct. But the Or Sameach's answer is basically saying what you're saying, that there's no difference. The difference is that usually it's just divine foreknowledge. In Perek Vav, when it's a nevuah, it's not just divine foreknowledge, it's human foreknowledge. And the Rambam assumes that that's incompatible with free will, and that's why he needs to give a different answer.
Right, I mean, the only way you're able to maintain free will and latter answer is by saying that it's human knowledge. It's in the realm of the human as opposed to divine.
That's what the Mahalich of the Or Sameach is. And again, I think it's totally correct. I think that there's also another Nakuda that distinguishes between Parakeh and Parak Vav, which you see in the language of the Rambam, which is, one is it's an issue of a gzera. So I think he's answering a different question as well. But as I said, I think it is true. In other words,
can you say that the human factor isn't so consequential?
Well, according to the Rambam, it's mistaber that it would be.
Well, it seems I can understand Chapter 5 is just kind of logical next question to ask following.
Well, he's already answered the question. How is it the next question? It's a rip. If you don't give the chiluk let's say, the Or Sameach, or the other chiluk we said. If you don't give that chiluk, it's not the logical next question, it's a repetition of the same question, which is exactly what the Lecha Mishnah asks. And the answer they gave in Perek Hei would answer Perek Vav. So you have to have some distinction. So we gave two. I think they're both correct. But he's clearly not giving the same question. He has a different question. He's not repeating himself, and he has a different answer. Okay. So what about the Ravid? As we noted also, the Ravid doesn't give the same answer he gave in Parakeet. So what does the Ravid answer? The Inyan HaMitzrim Eina She'ela Mishnei Panim Ha'echad, again 142 Ha'echad Ki Adavar Yadua She'ein HaBorei Nifra Me'adam Ra Ela Birami Menu Ve'achar She'yifra Mizeh Yachzor V'yifra Min HaRami Menu Birisho V'chein Hu Omer Hoy Ashur Shevet Api Katim Chashodeid Tofes Toshet Tushat Perish Mepnei Rishacha v'godel libcha v'hisparacha alai. So Ashur was also Shevet Api, in the sense that they were carrying out the divine command, the divine gzeira to punish the Jewish people when they exiled the 10 tribes. But then HaKadosh Baruch Hu punished them for the evil that they perpetrated and the arrogance that they displayed. V'amitzrim gamkin rishayim hayu v'ru'uyin l'mako sahem v'ilu shamu l'moshe b'tchila v'sholchu es Yisrael lo hayu lokim v'lo tavu b'yam aval zdono shel paro uvazoso es habore yisborach lifnei shlucho hu garam lo. So Ravid says a fascinating thing. Let's say the Mitzrim had immediately listened to Moshe. The Mitzrim, having persecuted the Jews and thrown the Jewish children into the Nile and all of that terrible suffering that they brought upon the Jews. And Moshe came and he said, Hashem told me to tell you that you have to let the Jewish people go. And Paro said, oh yeah? Okay. So then Paro would not have been punished, it would seem, for having persecuted the Jews. This idea, before we get to his second consideration, is fascinating. So, why is that? Why is it that if the Mitzrim would have listened to Moshe, that they wouldn't have been held accountable? Isn't their enslavement of the Jewish people immoral? So the answer is, the Ravid seems to be saying, that since there was a gzeira that the Jewish people be enslaved, then the Egyptians would not have been punished for carrying out Hashem's decree. But because they didn't listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he demanded that they be released, they were punished. And then, Vasheni, Ki Abori Amar V'inu Osam, V'heim Avdu Bahem Befarech, V'heim Isu Mehem, V'tavu Mehem, Kinyin Shenemar, Ani Katzafti Ma'at, V'heim Azru L'ra, L'fikach Neschaibu. Moreover, the Egyptians went much further than that which the Gzeira told to Avram Avinu had stated. V'avadum v'inu osam. But didn't say anything about killing, murder, throwing the babies into the Nile. And therefore, they were held accountable. But if they had simply been Mekayim the Gzeira, v'avadum v'inu osam, and moreover, they would have simply listened when Moshe had sent the message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to release them, then, according to the Ravid, they would not have been mished at all. Now, the question is as follows. According to the Ravid, you could ask that everybody who murders should be able to be let off the hook. Because if John kills Chaim, so we shouldn't hold John accountable. Because if Chaim was killed yesterday, it's because on Rosh Hashanah, or on Yom Kippur, Miyichyo Miyamos, there was a Gzeira that Chaim died. And John is simply carrying out the divine Gzeira. So, and the Ravid told us that you're not held accountable for carrying out the divine Gzeira, right? Had the Egyptians enslaved the Jewish people, and that's it, they wouldn't have been punished. So the Ravid over here doesn't explicitly answer this question. However, the Ramban in Bereishis Perek Tezvav Pasuk Yudalid on the Parsha of Bris Bein HaBesarim takes the approach of the Ravid as well, and he addresses this question more explicitly. I assume the Ravid and the Ramban are agreeing with each other, but it's a little more explicit over here. So let's take a look in the Ramban. Now, unfortunately, I didn't give you the Ramban, but I'll read it. V'da v'avein, ki ha'ish shenachta v'nachtam v'rosh Hashana l'hariga, lo yinaka listim ha'horeg oso ba'avor sha'asa ma shenigzar alav, hu rasha ba'avono yamos, v'damo biyad harotzeach yivukash. If somebody goes ahead, if John kills Chaim, so of course John is held accountable, even though it's also true that on Rosh Hashanah it was decreed that Chaim be murdered this year.
It's on page 39.
Ah, shkayach. Aval kasher osa dinim. But this is different. The case that the Rambam was asking about was a situation where there was a nevuah. V'avadum v'inu osam. Ki im shama osa v'ratzal asos ritzon boro k'nigzar ein alav chet aval yesh lo zechus bau. If he listened to the nevuah, and he wanted to be Mekayim Ratzon Hashem, then it's not a chait, rather it's a zchus. Meaning to say, if the Mitzrim would have heard the Bris Bein HaBesarim, now, I don't know of any evidence that they did, but if they did, and they said, we want to be Mekayim Ratzon Hashem. There was a nevuah that said the Jewish people would be persecuted, Be'eretz Lo Lahem, and Hineni Muchan Umezuman Lekayim Es Ratzon Hashem, and in doing so, they would have persecuted the Jewish people, as was stated in the prophecy. That would have been a mitzvah. And that's a chiddush. Why is that a chiddush? It's obvious that if there's a tzivoy from a Navi, so then you do whatever Hashem said. And even if you think that those actions are immoral or the like, but Hashem said, so Hashem says we listen. Kedus Yitzchak or the like, that's not a chiddush. That we listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if we happen to think that a particular action is immoral. However, there was no tzivoy to the Egyptians to enslave the Jewish people. There was simply a nevuah. The Ramban, though, is saying, nevertheless, if I know of the nevuah, and I therefore am trying to be mekayim the nevuah, even if the nevuah wasn't given to me, it wasn't a tzivoy, in fact, it didn't even have to be me. The nevuah was general, that the Jewish people would be enslaved. But if I say, I want to be Mekayim Ratzon Hashem. So that's not an Aveira, that's a mitzvah, even though it's an act that would otherwise be inappropriate, like enslaving free people. But if it's done l'kayem mitzvas boro, right? Like the Ramban stresses, v'rat lasos ritzon boro. A person acts l'shem shemaim to be mekayem the ratzon Hashem. So then that's a mitzvah. Kasher amar b'yehu yan asher hativosa lasos hayashar be'inai k'chol asher bilvavi asisa leves achav banim revim yeshvu al kisei Yisrael. Kadosh Baruch Hu says about Yehu that since you were Mekayim Ratzon Hashem by wiping out the Beis Achav, so then you'll be rewarded by at least having for four generations your descendants be king. Now, Yehu did what would otherwise have been terrible, wicked things. He murdered Beis Achav and the like, but there was a Nevuah. Now, again, it's a bit of a chiddush to extrapolate from there to here, because in that case it was a tzivoy, al pi navi. In the case of Mitzrayim, it wasn't. But nevertheless, the Ramban thinks that that's not necessary. That distinction isn't correct. The Ramban says this and has this idea in a number of places. I'll just give you one other. There are really many more. But another place where you see this in the Ramban is in the story of Yosef. So the Ramban writes that why did Yosef torment his brothers when they came down to Egypt to get the food? So Ramban notes the pasuk says Vayizkor Yosef es chalomos, and Yosef's motivation was to be mekayem the ratzon Hashem that he received in those dreams that his brothers and later the whole family would bow to him. So again, not a tzivoy. There was no nevuah that Yosef got that said you should make your brothers bow to you. But Yosef understood that those dreams were Ratzon Hashem, and therefore he did whatever he could to carry out those dreams. And even though in doing so he did activities that would ordinarily be totally wrong, tormenting his brothers, and even if you say, well, they deserved it, tormenting his father, the Ramban points out, his father experienced incredible pain. Yosef could have sent a message, and he didn't. And he allowed his father to have terrible tzaras. Why? In order to be mekayim the dreams. There was no tzivoy, but Yosef was mechavein l'ratzon Hashem. There are other places in Ramban where you see that as well. Those are two examples. And Agav, there are those that object. The Abar Benel, for example, on that Ramban says, I don't understand. It doesn't make sense. You have no right. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be Mekayim his Gzeros, however he does. You have no right to do what would otherwise be an Aveira in order to be Mekayim the Ratzon Hashem, unless there's a Tzivoy. So let HaKadosh Baruch Hu figure out how the brothers are going to bow to you. But you're not allowed to torment them or torment your father to be mekayim those nevi'im, those nevuos, unless it's a tzivoy. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says no. To be mekayim ratzon Hashem is a mitzvah. The Gra makes that point as well. So now, if the Egyptians had gone ahead and said, l'shem mitzvahs, be mekayim ratzon Hashem, and persecuted the Jews, like the Ravid said, that would have been a schos. Of course they wouldn't have been punished, but what did they do? They went well beyond that. So A, they should be punished for going beyond that, not for enslaving the Jews, but for killing them, and then refusing when Hashem said to leave. But B, it's even more basic, which is that the Ramban said that when is it true that being Mekayim Ratzon Hashem, even if it means doing something that's otherwise immoral, is a mitzvah, that's when you're Mechavin, L'shem Shemayim. But the fact that they went well beyond what Hashem said is a siman that nothing that they did was L'shem Shemayim. Likewise, the fact when Hashem said for them to go, and they refused, and this is what the Ravid was saying, so that's a siman that they weren't acting L'shem Shemayim. They weren't trying to be Mekayim Ratzon Hashem like Yosef was when he tormented his brothers. What were they doing? They were just evil. So then their actions are no longer a mitzvah. They're a terrible aveira for which they should be punished. It's not like a mitzvah. If I do a mitzvah, L'shem Shemayim, it's a great mitzvah, and even Shlo L'shem Shemayim, it's a mitzvah. But when you do something that's evil, that's immoral, and there's no tzivoy, so then, if you're not mechavein L'shem Mitzvah, it's an aveira. Going weiter in Ramban, aval imsha ha-mitzvah v'harag oso l'sina o lishlol oso yesh alav ha-onesh ki hu l'chet niskavein v'aveira hu lo. Right? Had Yehu not acted l'shem Shemayim, so what he did would not have been a mitzvah, it would have been an aveira. I saw, interestingly enough, that a comment in the Rav, of the Rav in Halachic Man, page 100, you don't have it here. He writes, Halachic Man discerns in every divine pledge man's obligation to bring about its fulfillment. In every divine promise, a specific norm. In every eschatological vision, an everlasting commitment. The commitment to participate in the realization of the prophecy. In other words, it's an interesting question, especially in the Yom HaTzmut time. There are other issues relating to the Mashiach. Now is not the time to go into it, especially because class is already over. But the Ramban at least holds, and here the Rav makes the same point. I think the makor for this Rav is probably the Ramban, which is that halachic man sees in divine prophecy an obligation to do what you can to fulfill it. Now, obviously, this can go too far. And one has to be extremely careful, right? Some terrorist who does it horrible acts, and they ask him, why are you doing it? And he says, because I'm fulfilling divine God's will. So unless he's a Navi, if he's doing what would otherwise be wrong, there's no justification. But nevertheless, it's a remarkable idea that the Ramban over here is taking for granted, namely, that we do... It is a mitzvah to do what we can to carry out the prophecies of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and even in cases like this. Okay, just one quick question before we stop, and that is the following.